Welcome to Origins, the podcast about the money behind the money. This podcast was created by Notation, a pre-seed venture firm based in Brooklyn, New York. We recorded this audio episode the old school way, in person, at General Catalyst's office, where I was joined by my co-host, Beezer Clarkson of Sapphire Partners. We're now recording more of these episodes with video. You can check them out on Spotify by searching for Origins. Our guest today is Adam Valkin, a managing director at General Catalyst. Adam leads the firm's global early stage practice and co-led its international expansion. He's been at GC for over 10 years after joining the firm from XL London. He has a uniquely global perspective on venture and entrepreneurship and has experience as both an operator and an investor. Adam, thank you so much for joining us. A pleasure. I know this is your first podcast. Let's start with just a little bit about you.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much for having me on your podcast. So I was born in Johannesburg, came to the US for college, was a tennis player. That was my ticket. Graduated in the mid-90s, had a lucky break through a family friend named Saul Klein, who started a well-known seed fund in Europe, in London, called Local Globe. And he was moving to Boston to help co-found a company spinning out of MIT, actually an early AI company. And I was graduating from Harvard on my way to Wall Street. And he said, mate, what are you doing? And I said, I don't know. I'm just trying to get a job to stay in the US. And he said, come check this out. That's how I got into tech, led me to venture capital in London in the late 90s. Worked through the sort of initial hype of the European tech ecosystem and then the downturn, which was especially brutal in Europe because the ecosystem hadn't been successful yet. So it was a little bit like the hangover without the party. But I was so passionate about the space, I powered through it, landed it up with my partner, Thomas Hogue, who was a early internet visionary, incubating a couple companies. And one of them was a company called Love Film, which was the Netflix of Europe. We landed up consolidating the space with some other really great entrepreneurs, people like Saul Klein, Alex Chesterman, and William Reeve, Graham Bosher, and it became the sort of European leader. It was acquired by Amazon in 2011. It was an important part of my journey because a lot of the other founders and people in that company were relevant, you know, in my career in venture capital, both in Europe and here. I ended up at Excel in 2009, end of 2009, beginning of 2010, worked as a partner in the London office. A good friend of mine, Sonali Dereiker, who I'd grown up with in European venture, had joined the firm and recruited me there. I spent three wonderful years at the time when Europe really came alive, but I had ultimately was called on a promise that I made to my wife to get back to Boston. And the two firms had a wonderful relationship. So I, in a sort of friendly transfer, switched from Excel to GC beginning of 2013 and came to the firm initially to focus on building the New York office,
right?
Then focused on Europe and Israel, and then more recently took over managing the early stage business globally. That's my story. I'm sticking with it.
That sounded good.
It's an awesome story.
We touched on GC briefly. You've been here at the firm 10 years. Curious how you've seen it evolve, how you think it might evolve in the future to the extent that you can. There's a number of different strategies within the firm. You run the early stage strategy, but I'm curious how you kind of think about those strategies fitting together and how you see the firm evolving in the future.
Yeah, so the story of GC in the time that I've been there, you know, has been, you know, quite incredible, certainly from my perspective. You know, the firm was founded by a very entrepreneurial group of people, David Fialko, Joel Cutler, Larry Bond, who was an early partner, Hemant Taneja, who came very early in his career. And they had an incredible hunger and desire to build a global firm and, you know, a leading firm. And you could see it from the early days, just the intensity, the energy, and the excitement about the business. The firm always had, at its core, a very strong sort of people focus. Everyone likes to say founder focus. I would say like people focus. They just cared about people, relationships, having impact, and it was very appealing because it was like if you met you know, if you met people at the firm, you'd be like, why wouldn't I want to build a company with them?
Right.
And I really liked that. And it fit well with my personality. I think I could not have imagined the firm would have grown and developed in the way that it had. I think we're very fortunate to be that we had founders who were very intentional about doing it. And we had an emerging force like Hemant, who had this incredible ambition and was willing to move out to the West Coast and start the firm there. It was a major move for the firm. A lot of the firms that had mentored the founders of GC said, if you really want to be a big firm, you've got to go to California. And they did it with someone who had grown up in the firm, right?
Yep.
So there was a sort of cultural connectivity. You know, and Hemant went out there and his first investment was, you know, Stripe. And then him and Joel worked on Airbnb and he led the Series A of Gusto and, you know, got into the B round of Snap. And, you know, Nico joined and, you know, Nico found this Snap on the Stanford campus while it was, you know, so they just went for it. And, you know, then we were very intentional about our expansion, you know, into New York. Joel and I came here, you know, every week. We built a team here and then we hired Ken Chenault and that gave us even more gravitas in New York. And then with Europe, we took it, Europe and Israel. I'd been there, you know, going there for 20 years, but we didn't just like blow in there.
Right.
We started leveraging our relationships, investing in like Series B and growth stage companies. We turned down a lot of seed and A's because we said we're not set up to support you in the way that would be consistent, you know, with our brand. So, you know, we came in partnership with the local ecosystem, built like strong relationships with the firms on the ground, associated ourselves with some, you know, really strong companies like Deliveroo and Monzo that I was involved in, companies in Israel like Rapid and Lemonade and Melio, which were some of the early fintech success stories there, Funbox. So we have played the long game, you know, over 20 odd years, you know, to be where we are. So that was kind of my observation of the journey. I'd say we essentially said that to be one of the leading firms in the world, we've got to invest in scale, we've got to be very intentional, and we've got to innovate. And not necessarily do what everyone else is doing. And I give a lot of credit to Hemant and Ken, you know, and the founders of the firm for being willing to do this and pulling it off. But, you know, we have an early stage fund. We have a creation fund where we've productized one of the secrets of our business, which was our ability to incubate companies and also to do larger growth investments where we bring one of our own people in to be chairman through our Catalyst Advisor program. Mm. You know, people like Paul Sagan, who ran Akamai, you know, Jonathan Klein, Getty Images, people with like real stature. Yeah. But we've productized our incubation business, you know, into a fund called Creation. And we are creating several businesses every year, including one that's got a lot of profile recently called Hippocratic AI in the healthcare space.
Yep.
Last year, we built a fintech company in Africa in partnership with MultiChoice, which is the largest television company there. So that's an interesting part of our business. We've also productized our healthcare activity. So in a relatively short space of time, on the back of Hemant's success with Livongo, which was an incubation, you know, merged with Teladoc, an $18 billion valuation, you know, he wrote a book called Unhealthcare about his view on the future of the U.S. healthcare system, which, you know, as you know, is 18% of GDP, highly inefficient, has some of the worst outcomes in the developed world. And we have built a infrastructure for healthcare founders that goes far beyond what a traditional venture firm would do. So we are plugged into 18 of the biggest health systems in the U.S. Mm. So any portfolio company that works with us gets, you know, access to health systems. And this is really important because in the health space, you don't disrupt, you know, there's no disruption. It's the same health systems now as they were 50, 100 years ago. It's all about partnering with the ecosystems, no matter what part of the health, you know, whether you're in services, software, diagnostics, you got to partner with the, you know, both private and public systems. And we've become the most active healthcare investor in the market. And also raised a dedicated healthcare fund. We've also built a thematic focus around what we call global resilience, which is essentially sort of coming to terms with the fact that globalization being the driving force is not really where we are right now. It's much more about like the national interest and countries, not just the US, but Germany, the UK, Australia, France, you name it, thinking, what do we have to do to ensure our resilience, to be independent, to not be dependent on others? And I think both COVID and now, you know, war has really exacerbated that kind of thinking. And the government's also expecting the entrepreneurial and venture ecosystem to get involved in this. And it's everything around, like, what is the critical underpinnings of our country? Like, what are the core verticals without which we don't really exist? Healthcare, defense, manufacturing, supply chain, climate, and how do we play a role in, you know, in that evolution? And then it's not, and then it's also about the partnerships. So we've been focused on the emerging partnership between the US and India, you know, which is critical to, if you take into account the dynamics between the US and China. You know, India's as big or larger than China, growing faster, investing significantly in infrastructure. It's actually booming, you know, has stable government, you know, whatever the views are on Modi's politics, and a rising middle class, although most people there are still very poor. So that's an area that we very focused on, and have a number of people focused, you know, including Hemant and Paul Kwan. And we've also hired some, you know, people from formerly military and government to help advise on that. We were early investors in Endural, which was kind of the way we, you know, one of the ways that we really learned about the space. And then, of course, we have a huge focus on AI. And we all know that this, you know, could be the thing that is as transformative as anything we've seen in, you know, our careers.
Okay, so we run a very small firm, 3 people. How do you collectively do that? Like, obviously, there's a lot of people that work at GC and are growing different strategies and working. My takeaway from that is just, how do you manage all those different initiatives across everybody in the firm and make sure that folks are aligned and sort of heading in the right track, similar to a startup or a company? Because obviously each of those on their own is ambitious, but together is just, you know.
You're sort of proving the example of, yes, venture can scale, right? Because I always grew up in this story of venture doesn't scale because it's 5 people around the table making a group decision, and you add more than that and it breaks down for the myriad of cultural reasons, right? So it's fascinating.
Yeah, so our firm's 170 people, around 40 or so on the investment side. And the secret for us is to work in small teams. You know, so we have our fund products, but we really work through sector groups. So we have our healthcare sector group, fintech/crypto sector group, core technology, which is consumer and enterprise software, where like a big focus is AI, and our global resilience focus group. And those 4 groups are relatively small teams that are moving really fast and trying to preserve all the good things about small venture teams that we know work really well. We also work as one team with the on a geographic basis. So we took the view that we would do better given the culture of our firm, which is very collaborative, very integrated, making decisions about an investment in manufacturing software or neobanks, whether they were in, you know, India or the US or the UK, is the same group of people with that kind of expertise, but with cultural sensitivity, willingness to move fast, willingness to travel, partners willing to go to Paris or London or Berlin if needed around opportunity. So we actually work in small teams around, you know, core thematic areas. And it's a lot of work to manage on the back end. And also, you know, for a firm like ours, we invest very significantly in developing, you know, emerging talent. Spend a lot of time on recruiting, but also on onboarding, experience, reviews, performance management. So we actually operate like a company.
Right.
We have like a chief people officer. We have, you know, a marketing division, IR, you know, finance and operations, legal. And those people are around the table in the key decisions of the firm as well.
Can I ask a question? And this is supposed to be helpful also for newer managers. And I get this question a lot. Is how do you know an investment judgment is happening, right? Because track record can take 10 years plus for a company to grow up. And in the training and the developing of new folks on your team or guidance you might be giving to folks who are newer to venture externally in newer funds, I get this question, and honestly, I think it's really difficult to answer. You are very smart. What does it look and smell like when the investment judgment, and can you teach it, or do you have to, is it a practice? Do you know what I mean? Like, you have to sort of learn through trial and error, and we can leave aside whether or not that's expensive, because there's that old adage of you have to, what, spend a plane's worth of money or something before you know you're an investor?
Yeah. The interesting thing about your question is I think most people in the venture capital industry wonder about their own judgment all the time. Because even if you have been very successful, you may have been lucky. Mm-hmm. You may have been in the right place at the right time. And no matter how good you are, you're going to make mistakes. And those mistakes like haunt investors, even very successful ones, right?
Yep.
And you can also lose your edge, lose your confidence. So I think it's not just a question of assessing, are people developing taste? There's also the question is, are you developing taste? And are you as good now as you were 5 years ago or 10 years ago, right? And there are some incredible people in that respect. Like my partner, Larry Bond, is, you know, past his 70th birthday. And I think he gets better every year, even though he's trying to retire. You know, he did Series A rounds of HubSpot and Demandware and BigCommerce and Black Duck Software, and bet he could do it again. But I don't think that's the case with everyone. You know, you can become less relevant, you know, not have the same curiosity, feel like new trends are beyond you. You know, so I think it's a much broader question around taste. But I do think that a big mistake is to say, if you don't have track record, you can't progress, because it just takes too long. You know, some of the investments where I have done well, you know, in my past, it took 8 or 10 years before I even knew that they were, you know, going to be any good. And if my career was held back around that timing, it probably would have been unfortunate for me and a mistake for the firms. So a lot of it is about looking at the inputs, right? And I think, you know, certainly all firms want to see people that can source interesting things. So you look at the quality of opportunities that people bring in, and whether they have a good nose for founders and kind of gravitate towards interesting and curious and smart people. You look at ability to connect with founders and have gravitas. You look at people that find a way to know more about something than everyone else at the firm, because that's the advice I would give to a young investor. I was like, go find a lane where you know more than anyone else, because everyone will come to you. And you do see that as a recurring behavior of, you know, good emerging investors to really dig in, especially in the US where the business is so competitive.
Yeah.
And without doing that, it's really hard.
But also I'd argue that the opportunity set is so large.
Yeah.
That even at a big firm, there's always some space to go carve out your little expertise.
There's always space. And then, you know, I think certainly at our firm, we like people that build community and bring new people into the GC ecosystem. You know, some of our team have built a community. Max Rumpel and Alexa Leotard have built a AI community in New York as a Slack group for people working in AI, curious about AI. Some founders host events around it. We also like people that develop skills that are needed to be in the investment business. Beza, to your point early, you know, this is a financial services business. And I think the environment we're going into actually requires that people understand some of the basics of investing, a lot of which was not the focus over the 10 years before, because all the focus became about sourcing. So we do like, you know, people that are, you know, good at the math. I think there's a strong interest, especially now with AI and like more technical, you know, emerging investors, because that's a huge advantage.
Yep.
And certainly if you are both financial and technical and have some operating experience, I think you're very well positioned, especially for this environment.
And you should apply for a job at GC, I guess.
I'm not sure I passed the bar. I don't know.
Yeah, I would not be able to get a job at GC. I wouldn't be able to pass any of the tests that are now given.
Well, that's probably a good sign of successful firm building, right? It's like you wouldn't actually get a job at the own firm that you've built.
We're all supposed to hire people smarter than us. Yeah. So there you go. Let's talk macro today, which is
Fast forward from 2013 to
2023. Oh, yeah, let's just do it all. Let's do a decade in 2 seconds. No, this is not the Twitter version of a decade of investing. No, I was having this conversation at lunch with someone where this environment for newer investors is really tricky.
And for founders.
Because on one hand, it feels pretty sad and it's tough. And you get, there's a lot of macro news, which is not necessarily all up and to the right in a way that is, for those of us who have been through past tech recessions, if not necessarily macro recessions. Like there was times in New York when there was just, I was in a fund in 2000 that literally gave back the money because there was just, it felt like the right fiduciary thing to do for the LP base because the internet was, they didn't believe it was dead. But there was just very hard to see what to do in New York during that time. And that is not the case today. So there's all of that depth and texture to the investing world. When you get up in the day, when you're thinking about the investment profile of what the world looks like, given your experience, how do you sort of get your brain around even explaining what the market feels like? Because you can hear I'm struggling to use the right adjectives because it's messy.
Yeah. So I think the place to start is to actually think about what's happened over the last 20 or so years. Global venture capital in 2004 was probably $30 to $40 billion, mostly in the US.
Right.
In 2021, it was $650-700 billion.
It's crazy. You know that.
Yeah. And in the US, just from like 2011 to 21, it went from around $40 billion to 300 right. plus.
Yeah.
Right. And actually, the growth in the US was actually a lot lower than in other parts of the world because the US was already substantial. Mm-hmm. Right. So if you look at Europe, it probably from 2011 to 21 probably went from around 5 to 100 if you include Israel. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the emerging markets, the numbers, you know, even crazier, right?
Yep.
So like the India plus LATAM plus Africa in 2018 was about 10 billion and in 2021 was 60 billion. So the whole thing changed, right? Driven by a number of factors, including, you know, low interest rates and, you know, rising tide, cloud and mobile boom, democratization of entrepreneurship, making it easier to start companies from anywhere in the world, and also the application of technology outside of the tech sector into every part of the economy, the health system, financial services, you know, even, you know, now sectors like defense and manufacturing and
space
and, yeah. and areas that were kind of outside of scope for traditional venture capital. So the like inevitable that there's going to be some kind of pullback. And I think, you know, my partner, Ken Chenault, who used to be CEO of American Express, he always says that, you know, the role of a leader is to define reality, you know, but give hope. And I think that, you know, for entrepreneurs and, you know, emerging managers out there in this environment, like you got to remember, this is still probably one of the best times in history to start a company, because if, you know, the venture ecosystem's 20 times the size it was 20 years ago, it's probably 10 times the size it was 10 years ago. There's somewhere between 250 and 300 billion of dry powder at venture capital firms. There's still, you know, the activity dropped off 30 or 40% last year, and it may be the same this year, but it's still much greater than it was 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And there's a whole new set of opportunities to take advantage of, including obviously AI, but also, you know, lots of other things. And I think that it's important to keep that in context because people are very focused on the fact that it's much harder to raise a Series B or a growth round, which of course may be true, but there's still lots of financings that are happening despite the change in environment.
For folks who are coming back, for companies raising, call it A extension or B, in the next 6 months-ish, is there sort of guidance that can help them think about what the metrics are that people are looking for? Because there is a rebalancing or rationalizing, whatever the right adjective is. And it's sort of like the, you know, that moving walkway at the airport when you step off of it and all of a sudden you're walking again. How are you helping, how would you characterize that for folks trying to figure out what it's going to look like in, what, 6 weeks from now in September when it's, everyone's back from summer and it's game on again?
Yeah. You know, as we discussed before, you know, I was a tennis player by background, so I kind of think of everything in tennis terms because it's where I spent most of my hours in the emerging part of my life. So like my first advice to founders is find a way to stay in the match, right? Because you don't know how it's going to end. And, you know, the nice thing about tennis is you can be six love three love down and still win, but equally you can be six love, three love up and still lose. And I think, you know, on the entrepreneurial journey, no matter how successful companies are, they all have their moments where they lost a set or were down or weren't playing well. So rule number one is to stay in the match, because if you don't, then you don't have that opportunity to win. And there are a number of ways to do that. You know, the most important thing is to, you know, focus on building products that your customers are going to love and tell people about. So stay focused on that. But then figure out how to buy time, either by attracting additional capital or by restructuring and making the capital that you have last longer. And this to me is an important point, because I've now, having gone through the last year and a half and also drawing back on my experience from 2001 to 2004, is however bad people think this time is, it's not that bad. Because most companies in our ecosystem that raised capital in 20 and 21 have way more cash than any companies have had in any time in the history of the venture capital industry. And that applies at all stages, right? So it's not just the mega round companies, you know, the companies that raised a $500 million D round or $100 million C round. It's also companies that raised 5 million seeds when 5 years ago that would have been a $1 million seed, or companies that raised a $20 million A, you know, where 5 or 10 years ago that would have been an $8 million A, right? So it's really important to get real and be honest with yourself about what's the right operating structure for your company in these circumstances where capital is A, more expensive, and B, harder to come by. And that may well be like significantly restructuring your cost base. And like, you know, one example is a really good company that had raised a seed A, B rounds from the greatest firms in the world and did an analysis and said, we have 22 months of runway. Should we raise a top up? And was, you know, we said to them, well, think about, you know, could you restructure without giving, without throwing the baby out?
Right.
They came back a week later and said, we can do this and have 44 months of runway and not really lose anything and actually be more focused. And that's, I've seen that happen multiple, you know, multiple times. And of course, it's not a trivial thing, because you're talking about people's lives and jobs, but that is part of this industry, right? It's kind of the trade you make when you come into this industry. You understand that it's a step-by-step financing game. And what's most important is the survival of the entity, because if the entity doesn't survive, doesn't help.
Anybody,
you know, so you have to, you have to make these, this is part of our game. So even though it may sound ruthless, I think if you don't play this game, this industry, it doesn't work, right?
Can I ask a seed question?
Yeah,
given
please.
your view of the pre-seed and seed, is this a different version of the same experience you're seeing and working with companies on?
Yeah, I mean, the thought that was going through the back of my head that when Adam was talking was like, it's very difficult to know how to advise each founder in each specific example and when to encourage folks to play a little more offense versus defense. Mm. And there are even moments where you might want to play some offense in a defensive macro environment. And so the way that we typically think about, particularly between pre-seed and seed, is we're running an experiment effectively. And we have some thesis on a customer set or a market. And in many cases, I actually don't think there's a major difference between a year or 18 months or 24 months or 30 months, because we're running a very specific experiment. If the results of that don't come back all that great, then, you know, then we have decisions around, do we pivot or restart the company or give the capital back? But at that specific stage, I'm actually not sure a ton more runway helps solve that problem or fix that experiment.
Yeah.
So the question in my mind was between seed and A, or maybe A or B or B and C, like, is there some comp for each stage where it's like we're trying to accomplish some specific goal or experiment, or maybe we're trying to figure out the business model, or how do we acquire customers efficiently? Hopefully, maybe at B or C, or kind of through product market fit. So I'm curious, when you talk about with founders, let's call it between seed or A or B, are there specific goals that you're trying to accomplish more often than not at those stages? And how do you advise founders around how to manage runway through that? So like the example that you gave for that company, like, okay, we just have to get to a certain revenue number or a growth number before we go out for the next round. But if you were to maybe click a little bit earlier, curious how you might advise a founder. Does that question make sense?
Yeah, I think you know, one interesting phenomenon is that because of the fundraising environment in 20 and 21, a lot of companies were able to raise their next round long before they typically would have, right? You could say long before they deserved to in terms of where the metrics of the business were.
There are maybe even companies at A or B that thought maybe they had product market fit, or founders were funding them thinking they had product market fit but didn't. So those are maybe some of the diciest ones. But
so I think what you see in the market today is that there are a lot of companies that have the benefit of having raised the next round very early, which takes the pressure off of focusing on things that you think investors are going to want to see, and actually focusing on the things that you think as the founder are going to really create long-term value for the company. And that's like a real luxury.
Yep.
And I do really try and encourage founders that have capital in this environment to think in a first principles way about, don't worry so much about the next round, because you actually have infinite capital, you know, based on your current burn. Think about what's really going to allow this company to be special.
I mean, we even saw this at pre-seed. There was a moment in time, particularly around 2020 and 2021, where founders were so focused on building the product or the business or the metrics just around what would go into the fundraising deck for the next round. And the whole business was built around that.
And there's a whole industry built around creating that kind of support for founders, training them how to raise the most amount of capital at the highest price, right? Or at the lowest cost to them. And there's a question on how healthy that actually is for the industry, right? Because what really matters is building products that people love. That's where the really long-term durable companies are born. The other thing I would say is that, you know, one of the arguments in favor of restructuring, extending runway, is not to be defensive. It's to be aggressive, right? Mm. To be in a position where you can hire that person that wasn't previously available in 20 and 21.
Right.
Because talent's, you know, way more unlocked. And we should talk about that in a sec. But also to potentially acquire teams and companies in the inevitable shakeout that's going to happen over the next 2 years, right?
I'm so glad you mentioned that. Can you talk more about that? There used to be the heyday of the acqui-hire, right? That was a bit of a pre-bull market phenomenon, right? Back when people were sort of accumulating teams and it was easier to acquire a team of engineers than to start it. I'm wondering at what point will people start, and all of our crystal balls are, you know, sort of fuzzy. So this is not a, what is your sentiment of how it's feeling? Because I've been asked this question on a version of like, will venture funds, the small emerging managers merge? And I just don't think it's going to happen for different reasons. But I'm wondering about some of the seed and Series A companies and how that might play out.
So a few topics there. But, you know, one is, if you think broadly about what we do and what founders do, right? A founder has three things. Opportunity, which could be driven by their own talent, by the trends they're playing, by the industry they're in, by the vision they have. So it's one constraint, like, is there opportunity? Another constraint is talent. And the third constraint is capital. In this bull run that we had, capital became the least of the constraints. And, you know, there will always be good founders that are creating opportunity. But talent was a real constraint. So much so that there was a whole acqui-hire movement around an alternative way of acquiring talent, right? Mm-hmm. And there was so much money flowing into the venture ecosystem that every company was hiring. Add to that Google, Meta, and the big tech companies, you know, offering very lucrative deals. Now there's much less of all of that, and there's way more dislocation in the talent. It's much easier to hire people in this market environment. And that's a huge boon for companies, right? And that's one of the reasons why you want to be aggressive, because the kind of talent that may be available now is quite different to the talent you may have accumulated in 19 and 20 when the market was super tight. In addition, way too many companies have been funded, right? And not just that, there are always way too many companies are funded. That's part of the venture industry, right? But I think what was somewhat unique about this last period was that way too many companies were able to raise later stage capital. And that also made the industry much more competitive at every level, you know, customer acquisition, you know, companies fighting, bidding up, putting money in Google's pocket, but also the size of the prize because of competitive pressure on pricing. And there is an inevitable shakeout that will happen. You know, what is often described as the triage and consolidation phase, right? So on the back of a major platform shift you know, like cloud or mobile, the ones before, like, you know, the internet or PC, is too many companies get funded. They start looking more and more similar to each other.
Yep.
Some of them will make it, some of them won't. VCs have to pick. And then the companies start merging or getting bought by much bigger companies. And the benefit of getting really lean and mean is gives you a higher chance of maybe playing a leading role in that, because you can use your capital to acquire some of the adjacent or competitive companies in the space, or just be more attractive to companies that may consolidate the space. Because right. in this market, who wants to buy heavy loss-making companies, right?
Right. Are you starting to see that M&A activity pick up in the portfolio? Even if it's smaller deals or portfolio yeah. companies. Like, so one thing that we're seeing, I don't know if you've seen this, but, and this is maybe more specific to pre-seed or seed, is we're seeing companies that raise capital, let's say $2, $3, $4, or $5 million. The product that they launched didn't work. They have capital on their balance sheet. And we're actually seeing other startups acquire those companies just for the cash on their balance sheet.
Oh, it's like the public market reverse merger phenomenon.
Yes. Yeah, so
the, yes.
Like it's just the early beginnings of that, but we're starting to see companies acquire other companies. This is not as much what you're talking around. This isn't really playing offense. This is like a way to raise money in a weird way. But
this is highly inevitable, because it's kind of a way to delay reality on your own valuation, right? Because if you had to go out and raise a round, maybe a down round or dealing with structure, and acquiring a company with cash is an alternative way to accumulate capital without necessarily declaring a down round or structured deal. I think you'll see a lot of that happen. I also think that it's inevitable that companies will focus on multi-product to expand their ACVs, expand their TAM, and become more attractive businesses, and will make acquisitions to do that. And we're starting to see signs of that. I think the one thing we haven't seen is a lot of acquisitions by big tech companies. Some of that may relate to concern about antitrust, and some of that may relate to valuations. You know, this slow reset of private valuations relative to public. But I certainly would expect that at some point there will be sort of a big wave of M&A. Maybe not as big as they may have been because of some of these factors, but I think it will happen.
Zoom out. I have two last questions. They're very different. One, there's been a bunch of great tidbits for founders thinking about building their businesses over the next couple of years and raising capital. Any one tidbit or two, just having seen GC get built for maybe a VC, newer VC that's on kind of fund one or fund two, and things to think about, having seen a couple of these get built. And then my very last question is, do we think Carlos Alcaraz is going to be the best tennis player ever?
Okay.
I'm going to put you
on the
spot.
You can take the last one first if it's more fun.
I think it's too soon to tell on Alcaraz because the bar is really high. You know, to win 23 Grand Slams, or 21 or 20, like in the case of Federer, Nadal.
Or maybe 24 or 25 for Djokovic when all is said and done.
Yeah, and so, he will win more Grand Slams. Like, to do that is really crazy. And if you think about the number of Grand Slams they have between the three of them, you know, it's almost 70, which, you know, four Grand Slams a year, that's over like, it's almost 20 years of like the same three guys. So it's very hard to imagine that anyone will replicate that. Any one person will replicate what any one of the three of them did. But I think if you were looking now and said who has the best chance, you'd probably say Alcaraz. But I do think it's highly impressive that he's rose to being number one in the world so quickly and has already won two slams. And he seems to be the full package.
Yeah.
The other thing I'd say about him is he did what Nadal and Djokovic did over a much longer period, which was he buffed up. You see a lot of the other players that are kind of as good as Alcaraz, they're still much thinner, which is fine in tennis. But I think if you want to go, like, if you want to be the best in the world, it's such a physical sport.
Yeah.
That he just said at 18, he looked at the other three and he said, okay, what do I have to do? And he just did it. Like, in 1 year, his body transformed.
Yeah.
So it kind of shows you what kind of mindset he has and what kind of killer he is.
Yeah.
And I respect that.
You should start a tennis podcast.
I don't think I'm current enough. So back to your other question.
Yeah, last tidbit.
So one thing I say is, I didn't build a firm, right?
Sure.
But I have been involved in some incredible firms, you know, throughout my career, and obviously learned a lot and have tried to mentor, you know, lots of emerging managers actually all over the world. But I've also watched the incredible mentorship that my partners have given to other firms, which, you know, the involvement that GC has had in the launch and scaling of emerging managers is a little bit of the untold story of GC, maybe for another time. But it's certainly been incredible to see it. And one of the reasons that they did it is that's how GC was set up, through the kindness of the firms in Boston. You know, all the big older firms in Boston got behind David and Joel when they started, invested money in the fund, taught them how to fundraise, introduced them to LPs. And they have always focused on doing that for others in economic and non-economic arrangements. It's always been part of the culture of our firm. And everyone gets like really excited when someone we know and have a relationship wants to start a firm. How can we help? What are the right ways for us to get behind? You know, the advice I have for anyone starting a firm would be to really ask yourself, why? Is this really your calling? And this will be your life's work if you do it, you know, properly, and it will take everything from you. So does it just sound like a cool thing to do? And is it a lifestyle choice, or are you really trying to create something special? Second thing is, and to be honest with yourself about what you want to achieve and whether you actually can, and to be realistic, you know, to be very ambitious, but also to be realistic. Third thing I'd say is, like, what do you want to stand for? Like, what do you want to stand for? Because getting into this business at this stage, given the growth story of this industry that we spoke about, I think it's important to know what you stand for as a new entrant, right?
Yeah.
And it works. Like, we've seen incredible new entrants into the business, right?
Yeah. And specifically, know what you stand for through the lens of what a founder might hear and how you might partner with them and why they might, that might appeal to them or feel different than what's available in the market.
Yeah. And, you know, what I learned, Joel Cutler would, you know, his advice was always like, be really present with founders. You know, it's the single most important thing. How does that meeting, that meeting you have with them, it may be one in 10 meetings you're doing in that day, but for them, it's like everything, and they'll remember every single thing about it. And that gets lost a bit in our industry, especially during the sort of bull market, because people were so busy and so overscheduled, and there were so many, we weren't going to raise a round, but we got a term sheet from whoever. We started our process yesterday. It's probably going to be done on Thursday. And everyone's just scrambling around, and you forget that the basics of this business is people coming to talk to you about their life's work. And in that half an hour or hour, the impression you leave will be huge.
Yep.
So just think very intentionally about, you know, what you stand for, how you want people to view you, remember you. In my experience in the business, I would say it's ultimately about, can you give founders a leg up? Can you give them an unfair advantage? Will they be able to do it faster or less expensively or with less duress because they chose to work with you? You're never going to be the reason that the company is going to be successful. At least not in my experience. Like,
sure.
None of the companies I've done well with, would I ever say that it was because they were successful because we were involved.
Same.
But I think that there would be many instances where they would say that we may have helped accelerate the growth. We may have helped save them from blowing up, right? We may have been there for them at a critical time, like to help them secure capital. So their story could have played out very differently, you know, without us.
Yep.
But we never actually the reason it became a great company. Now, there are exceptions to that, like, you know, Kayak, where Joel had an idea. He knew Steve Hafner. Paul English worked for Larry before. They said, hey, guys, let's meet. We've got this idea. You know, but those are like, you know, what we call like more hatches.
Yeah.
You know, Hamant with Livongo, he had an idea. He knew a guy, Glenn Tolman. They chatted, you know, Glenn built the company. But of course, if Hamant wasn't involved, it may. But the reason the companies are successful because of the CEOs, the founders, the management teams.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Adam, thank you so much. So glad that we convinced you to do podcast number one. I should mention we are in GC's office in New York City. You might hear some honking in the background. Lester will hopefully make it as clear as possible. But thank you so much. Thank you, Beezer, for co-hosting with me.
A privilege to be here. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Really wonderful.
It was wonderful to talk to you both.
This podcast was created by Notation, a pre-seed venture firm based in Brooklyn, New York. We invest in product-focused teams on day zero. You can find us on Twitter at Notation Capital. We want to thank our hosts for this season, Sapphire Partners. Be sure to follow their OpenLP initiative on Twitter and sign up for a monthly newsletter of LP and GP perspectives on OpenLP.com.